Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Emily Means. I'm filling in for Roger McDonough today. And today on the show, Representative Mia Love meets with President Donald Trump to discuss immigration policy, but not his S-hole country's remark. Governor Gary Herbert creates a task force to address the rise in youth suicides. The LDS Church gets a new leader who changes the composition of its governing first presidency. And later in the show, Salt Lake Tribune columnist Holly Richardson encourages women to run for political office. Those stories, plus your underplayed stories of the week and more on the show today. And joining me for the conversation is Tribune columnist Robert Gerke. Hi, Gerke.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack is also here. Hi, Peggy.
Hi.
Good to see you.
Yeah.
Health reporter Luke Ramsith in the studio as well. Hi, Luke.
Good morning.
And on the phone is Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Hi, Tommy.
Hey, good morning.
Oh, good. It worked. It's always a good thing when you come through. And remember, you can join us with your thoughts, questions, and comments by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And Tommy, we're going to go to you first. We're going to talk national news and address the possibility of a government shutdown. Congress needs to pass a new spending bill to fund the government, and the linchpin here is DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Tommy, what does it look like over there? Are we going to have a shutdown, and what role will Utah's delegation have in this?
You know, it's one of those things I always, we always come to the brink of this in Washington about every few months, and I never think it's going to happen until it actually does. In 2013, I was wrong. I didn't think we were going to actually shut down. We did for 16 days. Right now, it's not looking good. If you recall, like last night, the Senate couldn't even figure out how to adjourn. They were literally like facing a crisis of people were objecting to adjourning. So at the moment, I'm not sure. The House passed the bill last night, the spending bill. It's another, you know, kick it down the road for 1 month. But the Senate doesn't seem to have the votes. Rand Paul and Mike Lee from Utah are against it. And at the moment, it's not looking good.
Not looking good. And I guess they'll decide by midnight tonight?
That's the deadline. There's still negotiations going on. The easiest fix is for the Senate just to pass the House bill, which does, again, just, you know, 1 month extension, but the government continues to run. There's also a possibility that we end in this, you know, two-day crisis. The weekend starts tomorrow, right? So if they don't pass a budget, it's not like federal workers are really coming to work tomorrow for the most part. You know, some are, obviously, but for the most part, you know, it's a weekend, so it's not a big deal. And maybe it's a one-day, two-day shutdown, or it could be longer. At the moment, it's not looking good because all Democrats pretty much are against this. I think there were six Democrats who voted for the House bill last night. In the Senate, there's most all Democrats, and even a couple Republicans, like I mentioned, are against it.
So if it does happen today, you wrote about the potential effect on Utah's national parks. The shutdown in 2013 caused a crisis for national parks, but that might not be the case this time around?
Yeah, the Interior Department is working to try to keep parks open, and there's some controversy about that, too. The idea is the Interior Department doesn't want to make this the same doesn't want to have the same outrage it got from the public last time, if you recall. They literally put fencing around the World War II Memorial. They, you know, put up the closed sign at Arches and Canyonlands and other national parks. And that became the public face of the shutdown. They're trying to avoid that this time by saying, okay, well, we'll just leave everything accessible. We won't have people taking, you know, fees at the gates. We won't have concessions, but you can go see the public lands. And the pushback now is saying, well, that's irresponsible because you're pretty much saying the public can come into these you know, vast spaces of public lands, but without any supervision in any sort. So maybe somebody decides to do whatever the heck they want. It could be damaging to the parks long term.
Well, and I guess some people might not view keeping the national parks open as an essential. So is this really just to, I don't know, save face? Is it kind of like a publicity kind of thing? Or, I don't know, maybe Gerke should comment on that.
Well, I'll let Gerke go in a second, but I think the idea is on the Republican side, they don't want to have the closed signs. They don't want to have the members of Congress pushing through fences to let veterans go to the World War II Memorial. On the other side, you have to say that there's a reason that we have park rangers employed, and we you know, tell visitors what to do and what they can do when they go to a park, because these are things that can be damaged in some sort.
So like you mentioned, the government is often on the brink of a shutdown over the budget and kind of kicks the can down the road until they find an 11th hour solution. Robert Gerke, do you want to comment on the potential shutdown or on DACA, since that's
right.
It seems like that's what this hinges on.
Well, it seems like, I mean, we keep running into these issues. Again, this is these shutdowns seem to be arising with increasing frequency because Congress is just incapable of doing what they're supposed to be doing. And that, I mean, the most fundamental thing Congress is supposed to do is pass a budget. And, you know, the fact that they can't even do that, and now they're facing a shutdown for the second time in 5 years, 4 years, I guess, is kind of beyond comprehension. And you know, it's nice that they want to keep the parks open, but parks, as you mentioned, are not an essential service. And these shutdowns should hurt, you know. They should sting a little bit, because people need to understand, it needs to resonate, or it needs to show up on people's front porch that the government is not running because they're incapable of running, and they need to be held accountable for that, I think. You know, the inclusion of the DACA piece, it's one of the things that's been irritating with Congress for a while, is that they can't do the right thing for the sake of doing the right thing. They can't pass a budget for the sake of passing a budget. They can't pass a DACA bill for the sake of passing a DACA bill. They've got to make these deals, and you know, it they don't need to be linked together. But also, you know, everybody seems to think that they need to find a solution to DACA, but they're not even focused on finding a solution to DACA. It's become a political football. And you've got all these kids. Well, a lot of them aren't even kids anymore. A lot of them are now adults because they've been here for so long, whose lives are in the balance, waiting for Congress to actually step up and do its job. And you know, there's just so much incompetence in Washington right now. And it seems to be getting worse and not better.
So,
Emily, if I can jump in here,
I'm
in Washington, so there's some smart people still left here.
It's not all incompetent, Stubby.
But I understand your point. This would be, by the way, if it does shut down, the first government shutdown in history where one party controls Congress and the executive branch. Before, it's usually, you know, like it was in 2013, yeah. Obama was president, Republican Congress. Was it 1994? Clinton was in office, Republican conference, Congress. So this would be one where literally the Republicans hold enough seats to pass a budget. It's that they also can't get all of their own members to vote for it when the Democrats are against it.
Right, and then they turn around and try to blame the Democrats for, you know, shutting down the government. It's kind of mind-boggling when you try to go through the mental gymnastics they have to do to contort this into play the blame game rather than, again, doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Well, that's what I was just going to ask you, Gerke. Who is to blame here? I think I saw a tweet from Paul Ryan this morning saying, you know, the Democrats are using DACA recipients as a political football.
But
is it, I mean, where does the blame lie here?
Well, I think if there was any trust, the Democrats would probably go along with an extension, but there's no trust right now, and there's no trust that the Congress is serious about resolving the DACA issue. So they are using it as a leverage point. And, you know, it's brinksmanship, but I also think that they think that nobody's going to believe it's their fault that the government's being shut down when, as Tommy mentioned, Republicans are in control of everything. Look, I think DACA is something that they need to get taken care of, and whether they do it through this extension or whether they do it, you know, after, you know, they get the budget resolved is sort of irrelevant. But, you know, it is a high stakes gamble to shut down government because of DACA, because of anything. And last time they did it, it cost the government a lot of money because, you know, to keep these things going, to sort of shut everything down and then ramp everything up again, it actually cost taxpayers a lot of money. And I think it's short-sighted. And
I think it's like $15 billion a day to the economy.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I think it's short-sighted and sort of an ill-advised gamble if Democrats think that it's going to serve them well in the long run.
Well, I guess we'll see what happens throughout the day. I guess we'll know by the end of the day. But let's turn to other news you covered this week, Tommy. Representative Mia Love had a meeting with President Trump, and it might have been kind of an awkward meeting between them, because last week Representative Love called on the president to apologize for the way he talked about Haiti and African countries, and her parents are, of course, Haitian immigrants. So did her call for an apology come up during the meeting?
Apparently not. So I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall for this one, as I would like to be a fly on the wall for all Oval Office meetings. But in this situation, the Congresswoman obviously got the meeting because of her very strong statement last week, because of the president's vulgar comment. She called for him to apologize. She said it was, antithetical to American values. And she gets in the Oval Office, sit down for 30 minutes, and there's only a few people in the room. It's literally like, Mia Love, her chief of staff, legislative affairs person, the president, maybe a couple others. But she did not bring up requesting an apology. She did not say that he needs to, take his words back in any way. And the argument is she figured it would be more productive with the president to talk about going forward and what immigration reform needs to be than to try to focus on one word he said last week. And just to, not defend her, that's not my job, but in some ways you have to understand that, with the president, he apparently kind of doesn't like people who ever criticize him. I've heard this whole fake news thing before. So
I don't know anything about that.
she's concerned that if she had brought up, you need to apologize, the meeting's over in 3 minutes.
So they talked about immigration reform, and I assume DACA. Where does Mia Love fall on those issues?
Yeah, it sounds like it. And she's been obviously very forefront about talking about the need to pass some kind of reform for the Dreamers. She has voted for it before. It's all tied up in the politics of Washington in some ways, though. So. The reason DACA is not in the budget bill is because there's some concern that you would lose a lot of House conservatives if you include that in the budget bill. So they didn't want to lose those guys, so they didn't include DACA in the budget bill. But she did vote for last night the bill, which doesn't include DACA, but it does include a 6-year extension for CHIP. It does, keep the government running. But I'll leave it up to the others to decide her motivations.
Well, Gerke, I wanted to go back to the president's comment. He called these countries S-hole countries. I think we've all heard this by now.
We're going
to tiptoe around it. KCPW is a small station, But Love said that comment was racist. Trump has said on multiple occasions that he's the least racist person, but it turns out that if you're in Congress, I guess you still have to work with him.
Yeah. I mean, look, Mia Love kind of turned tail and ran, I think, when she was faced with when she was meeting with the president. It's not exactly profiles and courage to speak truth to power from a press release and then not do it when you're in the room with him. But I get that she was, maybe trying to move the ball forward. I don't know how much she can do that in a 15-20 minute meeting, and I doubt they actually, resolved all these issues. But, I think it's telling. I think that she was able to get the meeting, obviously, because of her position, her statement previously. Her position is the only sort of Haitian and the only member of Congress with Haitian ancestry, I think. I think, look, you've got to, she needs to work with the president, so she's going to try to maintain that relationship as best she can. But if you're going to say something in a press release, you should be willing to say it in person, I think, as well.
Mia Love might not have brought up the comment or the request for an apology, but do you think that she set herself apart from the rest of the Utah delegation by saying anything about it?
I think she did. I mean, I think that, nationally speaking, she was one of the few members of Congress to criticize not one of the few members of Congress to criticize the statement, but
she is
a Republican. But she also, because of her position in Congress, is the only you know, black female and Haitian ancestry, I think it resonates a little bit. And so it got national attention when she criticized him, and she did some of the, you know, national programs talking about this. And, you know, she seemed, her statement was firm and aggressive, and then, you know, and then obviously less so when she was in the meeting with him. So, you know, did it move the ball? It didn't move the ball. I mean, it's not, she's not, you know, she's not going to move the president on the DACA issue or on, you know, she's not going to change his mind about the racist comments that he made. You know, the president, it's not the first time, it won't be the last time this president makes comments that are, you know, disparage minority groups. But, you know, from a local standpoint for her constituents in Utah, I think, yeah, it probably does set her apart from the rest of the delegation and the rest of Congress.
Might not even
and Emily,
be.
If I can
yes,
add,
go ahead.
I think Senator Hatch's comments were, his response was essentially, I would like to learn more about this.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think there is more to learn about this? I'm just going to put it out there. All the same, let's move on to local news. We'll do that after we head to a break. When we come back, the governor sets up a task force to address youth suicide, and the LDS Church sees a change in leadership. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is Behind the Headlines. I'm Emily Means with KCPW. I'm joined in studio by Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke, religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack, and health reporter Luke Ramseth, and also on the phone by Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Luke, you reported this week that Governor Herbert launched a new task force on teen suicide. Maybe you can talk about what's propelling that.
Yeah, it's a kind of fast rising youth suicide rate in Utah over the past few years. I mean, if you look back as recently, even as like 2007, there were 10 youth suicides in Utah. And that's pretty much been steadily growing. I mean, you go to 2010, there's 21, creeps up to 31 by 2013, 44 by 2015. And that's roughly, I think, where we stand after 2017. So there's been a really fast rising suicide rate of all age groups, but I think for folks like the governor, I mean, the youth suicide rate is certainly especially concerning. So that's kind of what is behind it, I think.
Didn't Governor Herbert mention that suicide is the number one cause of death for young people in Utah at this point?
Yeah. I don't know as of when that is, but yeah, it is now the leading cause of death with that around 44 deaths in the last couple of years.
Well, who's on this task force?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting mix, and apparently it really came together pretty quickly. I talked to a few people that said they were only contacted about it, only heard about it in just the past couple of days. But you've got some kind of heavy hitters. Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox and Representative Steve Ellison, who's been kind of a suicide prevention advocate in the legislature, are going to co-chair it. And then you've got people like Gail Miller, owner of the Jazz, Intermountain Health CEO, Ronald Rasband, member of the Quorum of the 12, who are on it. And then there's a few, quite a few suicide experts, prevention folks, people like Taryn Aiken with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and Dr. Doug Gray up at the U, who's been on kind of the suicide issue for a while, doing research and that kind of thing.
So it sounds like a pretty diverse group of people. Did the governor give a reason for having these particular people on the task force?
No, I don't think so. But I do think it's kind of a interesting cross-section of folks in terms of you got some expertise on there. It does seem like a lot of the kind of heavy hitters that have been vocal about suicide in Utah before youth suicide. And he did say, you know, there's one faith leader on there, but he mentioned that perhaps he'd add a few more. So
yeah,
could grow a little bit.
I think that's interesting, too. Ronald Rasband, you said?
Yeah.
From the Quorum of the 12. Do you know what kind of role he'll have?
I don't know. No, I mean, maybe Peggy would have a better sense of that. But yeah, I don't know.
Peggy, do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't know what role he'll play. I don't know what his background in terms of that is. He comes from the world of business. So I don't, he doesn't have medical or, but I am interested. Is Gail the only woman?
No, there's at least one or two others. Taryn, and then maybe someone else. I'm not remembering. There's 14 folks total on it, but yeah, not a whole high number of women on there.
And they do seem like heavy hitters, not so many medical or social work people.
Some of them are kind of names, right?
Some of them are names that have been vocal about it. They're not experts, but there's also a lot of the kind of state's experts. I mean, Kim Myers, who's the state suicide prevention coordinator, is on there. So there's kind of an interesting mix, I guess.
So the governor's asking for recommendations, and he wants a pretty quick turnaround on those recommendations. Is that to coincide with the legislative session, or?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's what kind of probably drove a lot of this is you know, putting this together pretty quickly is just the session coming up. And it's interesting. Yeah, he asked that the group meet with the Suicide Prevention Coalition, which is sort of like already a group that's kind of similar to this task force that already exists. But basically, it wants them to meet with the coalition and kind of, I think, get their priorities in order and then come back by February 15th with like a report that says, here's what we know, here's what we think you should do. And then that gives the legislature potentially, I guess, time to, before the end of the session, to, you know, maybe take some action. I guess we'll see.
Gerke, do you think that is enough time? Is this an effective way to address this issue?
Well, I mean, I think there's probably some things that can be done fairly quickly, and there are things that are going to take longer, right? And so to do the easy stuff first, I think, makes sense. There's not going to be one simple solution to this, obviously, and that's why I think you see a broad cross-section of people on the panel. You know, and as Peggy mentioned, they could probably use a few more female voices on there because suicide rate among women in particular is increasing nationally. Utah's not alone in this. It's unfortunately a national problem that we've seen increasing suicide rates across the country. And so it will be, you know, I'm curious to see what they're going to come up with, but because it's not an easy problem to address.
Luke, do we know why this is the leading cause of death for people in this age group, or is that something the task force will try to address?
That's something that they'll try to address, but I mean, it's going to be even hard for them to address because we just don't know. So the state has hired in the medical examiner's office someone to dig into some of this research and do interviews with families. His name's Michael Staley. So that's kind of a more long-term project that he's going to have. But the bottom line is, yeah, we don't know why Utah has such a high youth suicide rate or youth suicide rate period. It's worth pointing out that other Intermountain states have similar higher youth suicide rates than the national average. And there's some thought that there's some research happening up at the U that maybe that's related to altitude. There's, of course, also a higher prevalence of guns in our state and other states around us, and that's often the you know, method. About 50% of the youth that died by suicide last year was due to a firearm. So,
well, I want to get back to guns, but first I want to ask you about one of the co-chairs of this group who shared his own experience. Excuse me. And it's difficult to talk about suicide in any setting, but this seemed like a pretty emotional story.
Yeah, it was. Actually, I don't know if Lieutenant Governor Cox has talked about this before publicly, but he did talk about kind of his personal story. And it was kind of emotional just talking about how his parents divorced when he was pretty young and he was bullied at school. And he felt like he was in a pretty dark place, maybe around 10 and into his early teens or something like that, and didn't realize that other people were feeling the same way and did have perhaps some suicidal thoughts. So, yeah, I mean, and he's the co-chair of this task force, so he's certainly got kind of a a really personal connection that he described on Wednesday at this announcement.
Gerke, really quickly on guns, and we have to wrap up this story, but Utah's a fairly gun-friendly state. Do you mm-hmm. think there might be any legislative action taken on the gun front here?
Probably not. Steve Ellison, who is on the commission, has sponsored some legislation in the past to encourage the use of gun locks. And is also they're doing a study. The legislature started a study, I believe, last year or maybe it was the year before, on studying the causes, of suicide and the methods, I guess, of suicide to try to get at the issue of, are guns a problem? Is the prevalence of guns, the access to guns, a problem, and what do we do about it? So that'll be coming, and we'll see what comes of that. But the legislature has a hard time enacting gun legislation on anything, and I think there's not an easy piece of gun legislation that would address this problem. Except maybe again, the gun safes trigger locks are an issue, are something that could maybe be expanded, I guess, or encouraged to try to keep guns out of the hands of these kids. But again, if somebody is intent on killing themselves, there's a lot of different ways to do it, and so you don't make it easy, right, by taking the guns away. But there's going to be other methods to as well.
Well, Luke, thank you so much for your reporting. And really quickly, when we talk about suicide on the radio, we want to be sure to give resources for prevention. So the National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 1-800-273-8255. And the local crisis number is 801-587-3000.
Can I add some real quick there?
Yeah, really
just
quickly.
We're the Tribune. We want to kind of gather some more info on people with experiences with suicide, especially youth suicide. So we've actually got a questionnaire on our website and our Facebook page. So if anybody wants to weigh in on that, that'd be great.
Okay, sltrib.com. Okay, religion reporter Peggy Fletcher-Stack, this was a busy week for you. It's been a busy couple of weeks for you.
Yeah.
And we spoke with you just a couple of weeks ago when LDS Church prophet Thomas S. Monson died. You talked a bit about his likely successor then, but this week the church officially announced its new leader. So can you quickly remind us about who President Russell M. Nelson is, his background, his involvement in the church?
Sure. The new president, Russell M. Nelson, has been an LDS apostle since 1984. He rose in the ranks simply by living, and he became the senior apostle, which meant he was, by long, long, long-standing tradition, became the new president. He was named. He was ordained in a ceremony in the LDS temple on Sunday, and then there was an announcement to members on Tuesday, and then a press conference also on Tuesday. So, yeah, it not a surprise that he became the president, because that is the succession pattern. The Mormon succession pattern is pretty set. The surprise came, a little bit of a surprise came, with his choice of counselors. The church is governed by a three-man first presidency, the president, and two counselors. The counselors are men that he chooses. Mostly those men have chosen the next couple of men in line by seniority.
But not this time.
Well, actually, Gordon Hinckley, the 15th president of the church, was the one who kind of scrambled the process a little bit by choosing younger apostles. He chose Henry B. Eyring, who was pretty junior in the quorum. And then the next man, Thomas Monson, chose the next man down from Eyring, which was German apostle Dieter F. Uchtdorf. So the process was already a little bit different. What President Nelson did was kind of go back to the previous pattern by choosing Dallin Oaks, who is the next man in line after Nelson. He was a former Utah Supreme Court justice, lawyer, legal scholar, also former president of Brigham Young University, and actually dropping out of the first presidency, the German, President Monson's German counselor.
Dieter Uchtdorf,
who's a super popular guy.
Yeah, it seemed like this really shook some members of the church and also non-Mormons. What about Uchtdorf resonated with them?
Well, he's been very popular, very charming, non-American, so that was an appeal to suggest that it's a global faith. His talks, his sermons were very accessible, very loving, compassionate. He had talked about the failings of church leaders, mistakes. He was just a very, very popular guy. Also very tan.
Very tan and very silver-haired.
tall. I noticed on Tuesday he's definitely the tallest man in the quorum. Not that that makes any difference, but
well, let's talk
very popular guy.
A bit about what this shakeup means for the direction of the church. You had a press conference with the new leadership this week and asked about what roles women and people of color and international members will play in the church going forward. Did they address the growing diversity of the global church?
Yes, they did. They talked about the fact that they... the place diversity shows itself in leadership is at the local level or a little bit higher than the local level. But I had asked him about, I asked President Nelson about diversity in decision making. The three men are white male Americans now with the German being gone. And their answer was, yes, there's diversity at the local level, but that it's not a representative democracy, so they're chosen by God. They're not chosen. They don't vie for that position. It's not a voted position.
It seemed like that response wasn't particularly well received from members of the church who don't identify as white straight men. And I'm thinking about Brindis Roberts of Ordain Women.
Yeah.
What was she and those other members hoping to hear from the new church leaders?
Well, interestingly, I had asked about, women, people of color, and international members. And President Nelson sort of forgot about the women. And I had to remind him, sort of a follow-up question, which I wasn't supposed to ask. And so Brindis, who is, as you say, the head of Ordained Women and lots of other, he eventually did answer about women, but the answer wasn't particularly satisfying to lots of women in the church because he mostly focused on mothers and wives and definitely nothing to do with decision making. So the women were identified as influencers, which means they are not the same thing as actors in the role of a leader. So Brindis was concerned that losing Uchtdorf and having no women there meant she felt that there were no one representing her perspective. And I did hear from lots of women who shared that view.
Kirky, you wrote a column saying that what the Mormon Church needs is a Pope Francis. What do you mean by that? And do you think that's where the church is headed?
Well, what I meant by it was, Pope Francis is popular among many Catholics, especially the more progressive Catholics. He's brought the Catholic Church back to its sort of fundamental roots of the Christian message of charity, acceptance, tolerance, and supporting your fellow man. And I think that was sort of something that the Mormon Church could benefit from. Gordon Hinckley was sort of this Pope John Paul kind of figure because he was very affable and outgoing and accessible. And I think they kind of, you know, needed somebody after, you know, because Monson's health had been so bad, there hadn't been a public face on the church really in that role for quite some time. And I think they could have used a charismatic sort of forward-looking leader. I'm not sure that President Nelson is the person to do that necessarily. And I think that the shakeup that we saw, especially with President Oakes and in the leadership, sort of points that they're going back. They're sort of retrenching into a more traditional sort of old-time Mormonism that, you know, we saw with in the Benson years, in the Ezra Taft Benson years, which, you know, it's the Lord's church. I guess he'll do what he wants to do with it. But I think in terms of the public face on the church, I think it's probably not the right direction. But, you know, they don't ask me my opinion on these sorts of things. Sometimes I give it to them anyway.
Some people have seen Dieter Uchtdorf as a sort of Pope Francis-like figure.
Well, yeah, I mean...
Because of rhetoric and style, not because he is in any way bucking doctrine, yeah. And nor has Pope Francis.
Right. It's not a matter of changing the doctrine. It's a matter of which doctrine you emphasize in your public messaging. And I think, again, Francis is really focused on, you know, lifting people up out, you know, helping the poor and things like that. Whereas Dallin Oaks is a sort of an old-fashioned culture warrior and is very much has been the point man on the issues of LGBT members and accepting those members. And also, I think, on Elder Nelson, President Nelson, on the issue of women in the church has been very outspoken about that. So I think we're going to see more of the same as opposed to, you know, again, President Uchtdorf was one of those people who was wildly popular because he sort of emphasized those points and I think resonated with a lot of maybe more moderate Mormons, you know, the people who are not the ones who feel like the most important issue on the planet right now is, you know, whether we accept gay members or not.
I would love to talk about the future of the church for much longer, but we're running out of time. So we need to go to a break. And when we come back, your underplayed stories of the week and a conversation with columnist Holly Richardson on women in politics. You're listening to Behind the Headlines. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Emily Means with KCPW, and it's time now for the fastest underplayed stories of the week you've ever heard. Robert Gerke, why don't we start with you?
All right. Brian Maffley did a really nice piece this week about proposed oil and gas development on Mullen Reef, which is this area of Utah that has a lot of Indian rock art and ruins and some concerns from rock art aficionados about the impacts that could have. And so it's really well told. It's a story that was told really well, and I think he did a nice job with it. Check it out. SLTrib.com.
Okay, Peggy.
Okay, there's a tech company, BioFire, that has declined to sign the parity agreement, which says, you know, we'll have equal number of men and women. That's because they already have plenty of women on the board.
They don't need to make the pledge, I guess. All right, Luke?
Yeah, I have a story today about Intermountain Healthcare and a few other big hospital companies that are going to start their own drug company. And this is kind of an effort to combat drug companies that are really rapidly hiking up prices and creating artificial shortages in the market and that kind of thing.
Good reporting. Thanks, Luke. Tommy Bird, do you have one?
I do. You know, this week it felt like a decade, but a couple days ago, the president held his fake news awards. By that, I mean he tweeted out something for a link that didn't work for a while. Sadly, neither I nor Gerke won one. We were really looking forward to
maybe
that.
Maybe next year.
unfortunately, it's one of those things that he pretty much called out news organizations who had made mistakes but then corrected them. I would like to point out that the president has said false things many times, several hundred times, and never corrected himself. But hey, again, I didn't get a fakey, so it's all good.
Robert Gerke, Tommy Burr, Luke Ramseth, and Peggy Fletcher-Stack, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Sorry
for the rush.
Thanks.
At the end.
Have a great weekend.
All right. The 2018 Utah legislative session begins next week, and during a time when gender equality is at the forefront of a national conversation, I think it's relevant to note that women make up only 20% of Utah's state legislature. So I asked Salt Lake Tribune columnist Holly Richardson, what does it take for women to run for office?
First of all, women have to be asked. and they have to be asked usually multiple times. So right here in Utah, Rhonda Menlove is a good example. She was already a professor, advanced degrees, and she was teaching classes on political involvement. And she kept talking about the legislature, and she had a student challenge her and say, hey, you're talking about it a lot. Why don't you run? And she's like, no, I'm not going to run. And it took multiple asks, and she finally said, okay, I'll do it, but it's just an academic exercise. I'm not going to win, but I'll do it to show you how it can be done. So she was so certain she wasn't going to win. She was home on election night. She had gone to bed like her normal time. And at midnight, somebody called and said, you won. And she's like, what?
Oh, my God.
And she spent 10 years in the legislature, right? But it's that's a very, very common story. And I think one of the things that I found that was so interesting is that women, A, they don't think they're qualified. They feel like they have to know everything about everything, right? Well, how am I possibly going to know 100% about every possible topic? Well, you can't, right? You can't do that. But the other thing is, if you reframe the ask, right, if you reframe what you're asking women to do, instead of, will you run for this political office, to, would you be willing to get involved to help solve this issue? Most of them are willing to say, oh, yeah, I really would like to do that. So women typically get involved in politics because they see an issue that needs to be fixed.
Holly, you have been involved in politics. Does this mirror your own story at all?
Yeah, it does. I had an issue that came up, and my background was in healthcare, and I'm a midwife. And there was a midwife who got arrested and charged with practicing medicine without a license. And so there were some of us that thought the law was wrong, not that she was wrong. And so that's how I got involved in politics, is there was an issue that needed to be fixed. And then when an open seat came up, it was actually a midterm vacancy. I did have more than one person call and say, hey, are you interested in running for this? I think you'd be great. And I'm like, yeah, I am. And I did. So, yeah, I mean, it's very, very common, very similar. And it crosses party lines. This is totally nonpartisan. It's whether you're a Democrat, Republican, independent, you run under any party label, you usually have to be asked.
Do you think this differs from the way men decide to?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought. Well, what's the deciding point for men usually when it comes to run compared to women?
Of course, we're going to talk in generalities, not in specifics.
Sure.
But what the research shows is that many men look at it as a resume builder. It's something that they can put on their resume. Hey, I was in a legislature. I was, you know, member of House, member of Senate, or I was, you know, mayor of a town or whatever. Where women are more issue driven, more want to fix problems driven. So women usually want to get in politics to do something, and men a lot of times want to get in politics to be something.
Again, we're going to get a lot of comments on that, I think.
Right. But even the research shows, not just personal experience, but the research out there shows that men's decision-making process is, do I have time? And, you know, how does this help further my career in a way that's different than the way women approach politics? And again, I said we're speaking in generalities, so we can all think of exceptions to those rules.
So we talked about a couple of ways that women decide to get involved, but it's not just guts. It also takes money. Of course, everything takes money. And that's the next part of advice from your column. Donate to women.
Yeah. So one of the things, again, that research has found, and this is research coming out of BYU, actually, just a couple of years ago, is that men typically donate only to men or to PACs, political action committees. Women, they donate to whoever they feel like best represents, you know, their point of view. So they'll donate to men, to women, to PACs or PICs. So when women are making these fundraising phone calls, A, they can't just turn to other women and say, hey, you're going to fund my entire campaign, because that doesn't happen. But the other thing that they've found, and this is out of Rutgers, is that women typically have to make 10 phone calls to raise $1,000 for every one phone call that a man has to make to raise $1,000. So they can do it and they can stay competitive, but it takes more time and more phone calls and more asks. And their donations typically come in smaller amounts, right? So it's not that people are necessarily saying no more often. It's that they, instead of donating $1,000, they'll give them $100.
Why is it that people are less enthusiastic about donating to women?
There are some really interesting studies. Women are not perceived as maybe competent, even at the fundraising aspect. People are a little more hesitant to support them, maybe a lot more hesitant to support them. I'll point even to Deidre Henderson, for example. I think she's great. I think she's a great senator. And she is good at fundraising. She has people who donate to her campaigns. But when she ran the first time, she had very little support except from her circle of family and friends until she won at convention. And then people said, oh, Well, I can take her seriously as a candidate and start donating. And I think that you see that played out over and over. But I think that donors, I think they don't realize that they're doing that. I think that they don't realize that their checks are bigger to men than they are to women, and that they donate more often to men than to women. If most of the men donate only to men, then it takes some real paying attention to what you're doing and what your checkbook is doing to make sure that you're also donating to female candidates.
All right, so we've got asking women to run, donating to women, but another part of this is to visibly support these candidates.
Yep.
Why do they need that?
So nobody can win a political race on their own, right? It's just not possible. So for sure, you have to get the voters to vote for you in at least 50% plus one, or at least more than the other opponents in the race. But one of the things I think that visibility does is it starts to lend this third party credibility. So when you see somebody in the business community who's supporting a woman who maybe her background is she's been a teacher, or she's been a nurse, or maybe she's been a stay-at-home mom for 20 years, but she's been active in her community. When you see somebody who's a business leader, for example, stand by that person, take pictures with her and say, I'm supporting her. I think she's going to do a great job for us. Then that gives almost permission for other people to say, oh, okay, well, she can be then a good choice for me. And, it's male or female. It does happen, male or female. But one of the things I think that happens that people don't realize is they say, I want to see more women in political office, but it doesn't translate to actual action. And so women feel like they're getting verbal pats on the back and not any actual support. So when it comes down to actually knocking doors or holding cottage meetings or trying to gain entrance into maybe different networks that they're not in at this point, they feel sometimes left kind of high and dry.
I don't know if you ever wade into the comments section on your columns, do you?
Oh, not often.
Okay, I did it for you today. I read every single comment on every story. But a common point that was made is we should vote for candidates based on their qualifications, not their gender identity. But with so few women in elected office, what do you say to that?
What I say to that is when we have the same number of women running for political office as we do men, then it's not going to be an issue anymore. And until we get to that point, then it takes specific effort to recruit and support women in political office. So people like to make fun of Mitt Romney's binders of women comment. But his real point, and this is bipartisan, it's happened on the Democratic side as well. His real point was, because I don't want to slip into maybe an echo chamber or my own little circle of people that I'm most aware of, I want people to actively find qualified women, and then we'll keep track of that. I also found in Indiana, they did the same thing, and this was on the Democratic side and not Republican, and they literally collected lists of women who were qualified to fill a variety of positions. So this is not asking people to vote based on gender, but to be aware that to get more women to run and then to win is we need A, to recruit them, B, we need to support them.
One thing we haven't talked about is some other barriers that might prevent women from taking on these roles. Of course, we are living in this Me Too movement. And I'm wondering, Holly, given that we're more aware of how widespread sexual harassment is, is that preventing women from entering into politics? Just the imbalance of power. I mean, just the numbers alone.
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does prevent. And I don't know that it's only sexual harassment is an issue. But the way you're treated in the political sphere is, it's brutal, right? And it's bipartisanly brutal. So people have been brutal to Hillary Clinton, and they're also brutal to Sarah Palin and Carly Fiorina. And it seems universally harsh, and it is harsh. So that's one issue. Women look at that and go, I don't really know if I want that kind of thing. And then when you're such a small minority in a quote unquote a man's world, and it really is, politics is still very much male dominated. I think the idea that you're going to get patronized and patted on the head, there is some of that that happens. There are plenty of people who do not treat you that way, but you are going to find people who do.
A couple of weeks back on the show, you mentioned something close to, kind of what we're talking about here. You said some state lawmakers were requesting male interns, that they don't want women as interns for what reason, I guess I'm wondering.
Well, the easy answer is to say to, quote, avoid the appearance of evil. And I think we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, but the answer to discrimination is not more discrimination. It's being able to treat women like people. So when somebody says, I can't have an intern based on their gender, I mean, it goes back, I think, to people saying, well, I can't trust myself or I can't trust you. And then the conversation just derails rapidly, I think, in saying, you know, how do we, if we say we want to see more women in politics, but we prevent access even on the level of being an intern, how are we ever going to get people basically in the pipeline? How are we ever going to have?
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Holly Richardson on women in politics. The full conversation will be online at kcpw.org. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, to Tom Williams, Connor Rivers, and Krista Black at Utah Public Radio. Also to Roger McDonough, who is hopefully enjoying his vacation. And thanks to you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of this program at kcpw.org, on iTunes, or however you get your podcasts. You can also catch up with KCPW on Facebook at KCPW88.3. Up next on KCPW Presents, a conversation about the 1918 and 1919 flu pandemic and how it affected the world. I'm Emily Means. Have a wonderful weekend.